We're exploring the rise of esports, competitive video games on the collegiate level here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. Collegiate sports marketing firm Learfield says the collegiate esports landscape is taking shape and competitive gaming will, or has already, become a core element of the college experience. But the NCAA, it said in 2019 it would not govern collegiate esports, at least not for now. And then you usher in a pandemic and esports kept buzzing through it all. Does your college offer esports? What do you want to see at the collegiate level? Are you a high schooler hoping to land a scholarship? 800-642-1234. Carolyn Henry is Senior Associate Commissioner and the Primary Esports Administrator for the Mountain West Conference. Carolyn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Good morning. You've had to play some esports in order to know what you are administering. And, you know, I'm of the Atari Pong generation, Pac-Man. And so esports are a different world. Things have obviously changed. When you started playing esports, what did you find with the content of these games?
So one of the things I did, and I'm of your same generation in terms of the video games that I played, one of the things I did was to, you know, go on to the site of, you know, our publisher to take a look at the games, and they're very high paced. It's different than your normal Ms. Pac-Man where you're playing against the machine, basically, but there are competitions set up, team competitions. As it relates to the content, what I usually do is, and for reference, I'm not a great esports player, but I do like to go in to see how the different characters are depicted. That helps to govern what games we play. So, for example, one of our games that we play at the Mountain West Conference is Rocket League. And essentially, that's a soccer game in a car. Mm-hmm. So we look at the content of the games. We have discussions with our institutional esports administrators to determine what games we're going to play. But it's quite fast when you get a chance to play. Obviously, if I was a little bit better, it probably would be even faster.
How do you select these games? I mean, what about first-person shooter games or the language that is used in these games?
So our institutions actually really weigh in on what games they play. And they go through a process on campus as it relates to how characters are depicted, how realistic are the first-person shooter games. So the games that we play, I mentioned Rocket League, isn't a shooter game at all. There are some games that don't involve any type of shooting. And that's, you know, kind of how we pick those. Again, we rely heavily on our institutions. There are some games that our institutions elect not to play, and we defer to them on that level as well.
I picture a student in a dorm room or isolated in their room and just gaming all day, also going to classes. But how isolating are esports, or is this the wrong depiction?
I think that's the wrong depiction. I mean, what I see on our campuses are esport clubs, the clubs putting together teams to participate in team competition. If you look at Riot Games and League of Legends, that is a team competition, as well as Overwatch team competitions. And then you could go online and actually watch the team competition. What's interesting is that if you're watching it live, and say, for example, you have a 5 or 6 player game that you're playing, and you can walk behind each one of the players, they each have specific roles within that game, and they have to work as a team in order to be successful.
We're talking with Carolyn Henry, who is a Senior Associate Commissioner and the Primary Esports Administrator for the Mountain West Athletic Conference. You can join in. What would you like to know about collegiate esports, where it is headed? Are you a high school gamer applying to colleges, looking for a program with esports? 800-642-1234 for your perspective. So where is the structure in all of this? I mean, there's the National Association of Collegiate Esports, which you have the member organizations, but how do you make varsity programs and who's playing who?
Yeah, one of the things that's challenging is there's no overarching structure that's similar to the NCAA. Each of the game developers have rights to the games that are being played. There are different structures, and you mentioned NACE in terms of helping to try to organize groups of players. What we do at the Mountain West Conference is, you know, we take all of our institutions that wish to play esports, which is all of our football playing institutions, all 12 of them. And we created a conference structure whereby there are certain eligibility requirements. When we're looking at the numbers of individuals playing, again, eligibility requirements, you have to meet progress toward degree requirements to set up some sort of structure. Each esport club within the Mountain West has to have what I call an adult non-student administrator so that the upper administration knows what's going on with esports on the campuses. But that's one of the more challenging things as it relates to esports, as it is the governing body. And that's because each developer has their own set of rules and they own the property of their games. It's intellectual property, much different than conventional sports where the NCAA can govern basketball. No one has the rights to basketball, for example.
Do you think should the NCAA get involved? What could help govern esports in rulemaking and recruitment and eligibility?
I think that it's challenging. It would be challenging right now for the NCAA, not that it would be insurmountable. And that is because of the nature of esports in that there are entities that own the games that are being played. And so there would have to be a lot of discussion and agreements amongst and between the NCAA and the publishers as it relates to some overarching governance rules for those particular games. And again, each of the games have their own separate and distinct rules.
How much do you have the ear of game developers or these publishers on how they craft these games for you to choose to have them? And how much give and take is there? How much leverage?
Really, the game developers determine the content of their games. We can provide feedback as individual conferences, and I'll use Riot Games as an example because I think they're doing a really good job of trying to understand the college landscape and trying to get feedback. And they've created what they call the Scholastic Association of America, and it's an advisory board to Riot Games as it relates to collegiate esports. And there are colleges and representatives from colleges and high schools on this board. I'm a member of that board as well. And we talk about how we can integrate what we're doing on our campuses and at our conferences with what Riot Games is doing. And they're very interested in trying to coordinate with colleges and universities to make this the best opportunity for students as possible.
I mean, the more they coordinate, the more they collaborate, the more their game gets out there, the more opportunity there is, I would imagine, for their company.
Yes.
Let's take on a caller now. Tom is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. So I watch a lot of Overwatch League and professional gaming. So do you guys stream on Twitch? Is that like the normal way of viewing the collegiate sports? I haven't really watched many of those. So
thank you so much for that question, Tom. Go ahead, Carolyn.
Yeah, there are a number of different platforms. From a Mountain West perspective, we do stream on Twitch. And if you check the front page, a lot of times they will tell you, you know, what colleges and conferences are streaming. We also on our conference webpage have our Twitch information, but that's our primary platform that we use. But over the last several years, other platforms have developed.
You know, Tom brings up the point of watching the professional level. So after the college level, what happens with like the professional and you know, do these esports students then, you know, go on to become professionals?
Yes, some have an opportunity to be professionals after college. Some are professionals before college. I think, you know, with collegiate esports, it gives students an opportunity also to be seen. And it's not dissimilar from conventional sports in that you take a basketball or a football student athlete, you know, women's basketball student athlete, and they are representing their institution, they're seen, and the professional leagues are aware of them. It's not dissimilar from that.
Carolyn Henry leads the Mountain West Conference in the area of governance and legal affairs, also serving as primary administrator of esports, where we're picking her brain this morning. Do you have esports at your college or university? How is it organized? How is it structured? Do you think the NCAA should have an active role in Division I esports? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Carolyn Henry here on the Ideas Network. Competitive video games at the collegiate level. We're tracing the rise of esports on college campuses on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Association of Collegiate Esports says it has over 170 member colleges and universities offering varsity esports programs with more than $16 million in scholarships and aid up for grabs. What do you think gaming has to do with college? Where does it fit in? 800-642-1234. Carolyn Henry, primary esports administrator for the Mountain West Conference, with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's look at those scholarships. $16 million plus in scholarship aid. How do scholarships work now? And what about recruitment?
Yeah, so the scholarship offerings will depend on institutions. I think it's a great opportunity for esports students in high school to have some of their education paid for. It varies from institution to institution. Some institutions within the Mountain West Conference offer scholarships for esports. A lot of times they are scholarships that are game specific. So if it's a specific game, our caller previously mentioned Overwatch. So maybe if it's Overwatch, it could be to participate in Overwatch at the institution. But I just view this as another opportunity for a student to have some of his or her education paid for and then play esports, which is something that they enjoy.
You said his or her, and I don't know that in my mind I see many women doing esports. How do you diversify your teams, make them more inclusive?
So what we've done in the Mountain West, and this is something that our institutions are working on, and it's an initiative to have more inclusivity with esports. And so I'll take a Boise State, which is within the Mountain West. And one of the things they do is they have like an open call for esports participants, and they try to encourage women and ethnic minorities to participate in esports at the institution. They don't have to compete officially, but they at least want to meet those individuals who are playing. Boise State has a really good Overwatch team, or they have in the past year. Their Overwatch captain was actually a female, and that showed other women that females also are gamers. If you look at, and I've read a number of studies, the number of women who play video games are about probably 48%, but when you get to the college level, that number dwindles. And so I think what we need to do as administrators is to show students, female students, ethnic minority students, the opportunities that are available. The more organized an institution's program is, the more likely they are to be diverse. And so we continue to work through that because I would like to see more women gamers. On the other side, one of the things that the Mountain West has done, or at least that we did when we had in-person competition, is to make sure that our casters or sportcasters, we call them casters, also are diverse. In the last two competitions, we've had one or two casters who were female and or ethnic minority. So just trying to show gamers that you don't have to look a certain way in order to play.
How do your students, how do your collegiate students train in esports? What is the time commitment? How do they hone their skills in these games?
So the students practice just like you would practice a conventional sport. The time varies, each evening, whether or not they're practicing. They also have to balance their classwork, but they practice their tactics when they're practicing with their teammates, and a lot of just technical issues that they work on within those games. But it's, again, not dissimilar from conventional sports. In order to be good at it, you have to practice, and these individuals practice with their teams consistently.
We're talking with Carolyn Henry, Senior Associate Commissioner and the Primary Esports Administrator for the Mountain West Conference. What games would you like to see played at a college level? How do you participate in esports now, perhaps in the future? Join in at 800-642-1234. I also have the sense that these students would be a lot of computer science majors. What are some of their backgrounds as they also pursue a degree?
Yeah, and a lot of them are STEM students, but some are not. But I think that regardless of what their majors are, they have one thing in common, and that's playing the video games. But we are seeing a lot of STEM students. I looked at some of the majors of some of our players within the Mountain West, and while the majority of them were the science, you know, technology, engineering, and math majors, there were some who were liberal arts majors as well, some who had interest in like broadcasting and things like that. But primarily, I would say the STEM students are, at least within our conference, are the ones who are participating.
What would you tell other conferences who haven't taken the steps that you have in the Mountain West? Because there's, you know, I feel like there are different degrees of interest and also commitment here from the athletic conferences.
Yeah, I think you're accurate there. You know, I would encourage other conferences to consider esports within the conference. Again, it's another opportunity for students as it relates to their education. It's competition. I think it can, you know, really help promote what the conferences are doing. At the end of the day, we have colleges and universities, and this is an educational setting, and it's another opportunity to provide educational funding for students.
You have, as you mentioned, Boise State, you have the University of Utah, both among the top 10 universities for varsity esports. What makes a really great esports program or team?
So, and we do have Boise State, we have Utah State, but not the University.
Oh, you don't have, I'm sorry. Thank you.
That's okay. That's because they were in our conference years ago. What makes a good esport program? I think the commitment from the institution, from the top. And so at Boise State, the president of the university supports their esports program. They put, you know, revenue or funding into the esports program. And then the organization of the esport program. Those are all things that help from an institutional perspective. And not thinking that you need a tremendous amount of money to get your esport program started. If you take Chris Haskell at Boise State, he's done a great job of building the program up from, you know, the grassroots and then up. And again, it doesn't take a lot of initial funding to create your program, but it does take some imagination and some creativity. And I think that's kind of what esports is about as well.
What about the pandemic? You know, as we saw traditional sports temporarily shut down at the start, esports continued. What impact has the pandemic had on this area?
As it relates to in-person events, which we also conduct, we haven't had as a conference in-person events, but one of the things that esports has done throughout the pandemic, and one of the things that we did as a conference during the early days of the pandemic, was to conduct still team competition, and the participants played from where they were. And one of the things that did was to keep each of our students connected to their institution. I think during the pandemic, when everyone was, you know, at home and not with their teammates, not with, you know, folks on their institution's campuses, they felt somewhat isolated. And by having that team competition, it kept our esports students connected to one another and connected to their institutions.
You know, broadband is still something that we're really struggling with here in Wisconsin, getting broadband all over the place. And surely, you know, college campuses don't have as much of an issue with bandwidth problems. But, you know, that is something, you know, for access, if you will, in leading up to the collegiate level, access is concerning there for people who don't have those speeds, that high-speed internet.
Yeah, and you know, you're right in terms of college campuses, and whenever a collegiate conference is conducting an event, we have the bandwidth to do that. One of the things that we'll talk about in an upcoming meeting is what our high schools are doing, what are some of the needs of the high schools that are now starting to play esports. And so we'll explore that and have discussions about what can be done to make sure that when you're playing at the high school level, that you have as a team those things that you need.
Carolyn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Carolyn Henry is Senior Associate Commissioner and Primary Esports Administrator for the Mountain West Conference. Just ahead, we talk with another candidate running to be Milwaukee's next mayor as part of a series of conversations we hope to have with all the candidates on the primary ballot. What questions would you like to ask these candidates? 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. We're talking with candidates in the race to become Milwaukee's next mayor here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Seven candidates are on the ballot in the nonpartisan primary election, less than 2 weeks away. Top two advanced to the spring election on April 5th. Former Mayor Tom Barrett resigned, as you recall, in December to serve as U.S. Ambassador to Luxembourg. What do you think Milwaukee's next mayor should prioritize? What are the city's biggest challenges and opportunities? 800-642-1234. Lena Taylor is a state senator who represents parts of Milwaukee, previously ran for mayor in 2020. State Senator Taylor, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's great to be with you again.
Well, start out with your top priorities for the city. What are they?
The number one issue is the budget. The budget is in extreme challenge, not just because of the pension for police and fire, but also because we have not gotten our fair share of shared revenue for some time. I want to say that the amount that we get is about equal to what we got before 2009.
So how would you address that issue? How would you address the budget and very tight times in the constraints of what you receive from the state?
So a couple of things. I've been on the finance committee for like at least 14, 15 years of my career. And the $70 billion budget that the state has is such that it has some of the largest surplus that they've ever had. And I would argue that that's partly because people like or places like Milwaukee has not gotten its fair share for some time. So trying to put it on the table to really show what the finances are like, I think, is important. And building that kind of rapport, I think, is key, because I don't believe that many respected the efficient use, the lack, I should say, of efficient use by the previous mayor with the budget. So rebuilding those relationships to show a different amount of thought in funding that we get, but asking for what's due us and putting it on the table and showing how that has affected us. Also asking the feds for help in regards to dealing with policing our court system, because we can't get individuals off the street who have committed crimes if our court system is 2 to 4 years backed up for people to get trials and to be processed. And then the last thing I'm going to do is build new revenue. We've got to create new industry so that individuals will come and that we can ultimately grow the revenue streams that we have here. So build new relationships through hopefully renewed accountability measures, you know, be more efficient with those dollars, you know, and do the other things that I've articulated, you know, is key.
One revenue stream in the moment, in these times, that the city has $200 million in unallocated federal funding for responding to the pandemic. That's from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. How should this money be spent?
The money should be spent in a way that makes that money make money for us, is what I'd like to say. Making sure that we're building capacity with every dollar that we spend, capacity in businesses that are created or happening and growing in our community. So that means if we contract with someone to do thing X and we don't have a number of businesses in that area, then we should also be making sure that we're growing businesses like Business X that did that work. Also making sure that we're tapping in, using our assets in every way that we can for our residents to get skills training, whether it's in the trades or whether it's in entrepreneurship. We need to be the destination for pre-apprenticeships, apprenticeships, and entrepreneurship. So I intend to make the money make money for us in those ways, but also spending it in the areas that you've already mentioned, areas dealing with our public safety and areas dealing with our housing, our lead lateral removal are three of the areas that pop up immediately.
I want to just for a moment circle back to pension that you brought up, the pension issue. The pension task force last fall, a quarter of the city of Milwaukee's workforce could be let go by between 2023 and 2025 if the anticipated spike in the city's annual pension contribution is not addressed. What would you do? Would you cut city services and staff? How would you make up for it?
Well, I think I've articulated earlier in the budget challenges, building new revenue is also possibilities. Building new industry, not just thinking that we're going to be stuck where we are. That's the vision and the innovative thinking that I think that I bring that's different than my colleagues, but also looking at other efficient ways that we can do things in the city and looking at how the pension is presently done. We may have to create new agreements for new individuals coming in. They may not be able to have the same prime rib pension plan at a time when we can't even afford ground beef.
So perhaps reducing the pension program in some way for future workers.
Correct. That may be what we need to do. It's not something I can do in a silo. It is something that has to be negotiated with the unions, and it is something that has to be discussed with the Common Council. But those are the types of things that we may need to do if we are not able to get the financial assistance that we speak about from the state, from the feds, or create new revenue streams and efficiencies within the city budget, all of which I'm hoping that we can do.
We are having conversations with all the candidates for Milwaukee mayor ahead of the February 15th primary, and we have one candidate on the ballot today, State Senator Lena Taylor of Milwaukee. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. How would your administration seek to reduce violence and reckless driving?
Oh, thank you for that question. This is, you know, an issue that's plaguing us tremendously. I'd like to bring the same plan that the city attempted to do before, but failed to include the community and the wraparound services necessary in order for the program to be successful. In particular, it's a High Point, North Carolina model, where let's just say it's like, let's make a deal. Curtain number one, we have all the intelligence we need to send you to prison. Curtain number two, we will wrap services around you and give you a pathway to empowerment to do something different with your life, to get a skill so that you're able to be self-sustaining. That model didn't work before because we failed to do the wraparound services. We failed to give people the supports in order to move to empowerment. That's the difference in how I want to be able to see that program implemented, because it did show, when done right, to reduce violence by 60 to 70%. We know that 20% of the people are doing 80% of the problems. So we have to address that 20% and be able to move them on an empowerment path. And if not, locking those others up and making sure that we're asking for dollars for our court system to move people actually through the process, because we now have people waiting 2-4 years in order to be able to go through a court process for a crime that they committed. That within itself is just not acceptable.
I want to address inequalities in the city, disparities. You see racial disparities in employment, in incarceration, as you mentioned, in infant and maternal mortality, health determinants, education. It's everywhere. How do you affect real change in these chronic racial problems?
Well, I think you have to first start with being honest that you have these issues. Second, you have to get rid of the failure in the various departments. I'm not certain if you are aware, but there was an audit that showed that the city of Milwaukee was saying that they did the work on lead, that when individuals, young people tested positive for lead, that they were testing their environments and that they were dealing with the remediation of lead at the levels and the way that they were supposed to. But the audit by the Legislative Audit Bureau showed that that was not true. And so the city was frankly just lying on its documents. And there was no accountability. And I know that you mentioned that the former mayor was able to go and be the ambassador, but that former mayor was a part of having an administration that did not was not honest and did not meet the requirements. So the first thing we're going to do is make sure that we don't have failing departments like we have with the Fire and Police Commission, because the former administration did not appoint all of the commissioners that we could, that they did not put standards in to prevent from misuse or misbehavior, so that we had huge settlements. So putting people in that are qualified and that will not have failing departments that are giving misinformation, that if a resident or a citizen like you or I did those things, we would have criminal consequences for our actions.
Sounds like you're saying you want consequences and you want transparency.
That is correct. Transparency, inclusion, and accountability. Those are the things.
State Senator Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lena Taylor, a candidate for Milwaukee mayor in the February 15th primary election. We're working to schedule interviews with all seven candidates on the nonpartisan primary election ballot. Join us Tuesday at 7 for our next Milwaukee mayor candidate conversation. Just ahead, we talked to a college student who read 365 books last year, actually more than that, and find out how that went down, how that actually worked. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Question for you. Do you think you could read more than 365 books in a year? And I'm not talking about board books. No Goodnight Moon. Oh, Margaret Wise Brown, you push boundaries. That's for another day. A UW student took on this challenge last year and did it. And these were hefty books, averaging just over 300 pages. Your questions, 800-642-1234. Kyla Vaughn is a senior at UW-Madison, double major in English and history. Kyla, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Well, I dare say, what on earth got into you?
I've always been a huge reader. It's always been a part of my life. And I read a lot of books at the start of the pandemic in 2020, 276, I believe. And so in 2021, I wanted an even bigger challenge.
So where did you land? I think I saw like 392. What was the final total?
Yeah, you're correct. It's 392.
Oh my goodness. Were you reading on New Year's Eve? Like, were you down to the wire?
No, I finished 365 at the beginning of December. And I don't know if I read on the last day of the year. I don't think so.
Well, you know, some mortals would actually stop at 365 and say, you know, that's good, mm-hmm. did it. But you kept going. What kept you just voracious, just keeping at it?
Yeah, part of it was I still had books to read for classes for finals. But then also during finals, I find myself actually having a lot more time than usual and over winter break. And so I wanted to keep reading. So I figured I might as well get that total as high as possible.
Shh, do not tell the professors that. keep that in. Yeah. So how much time were you dedicating to this? Do you have time to sleep and eat? How long did you go for stretches of reading?
I definitely did have time to sleep and eat. I can't say that I didn't stay up late to read some days, but we still got that full sleep schedule. And depending on the day, I read anywhere from like nothing at all to like 8 hours. So it was very variable.
Okay, so we're going to get to some page turners in a moment, but what was your least favorite read?
Oh gosh, that is such a hard question. I think that... I don't want to be mean to any books.
Oh, how did you choose the books? Like what were your parameters?
Yeah, so there are just some specific like genres that I really enjoy. I mostly read fantasy and romance. And so a lot of the books that I read fell under that. But I also just sort of picked up anything that like I sort of saw on the internet that I thought looked fun, or saw in a bookstore that looked fun. And so it was kind of all over the place. I read a lot of different things last year.
So you also read to gain empathy, I understand. Explain how reading helps you understand other people.
Yeah, so I think it's the best way to like really examine the lives of characters. While they are fictional, the human emotions that are presented in books are always truthful. And so it's stories that I'm never going to experience or live, but I can understand what the characters went through and how their emotions resulted from the conflict that they had to go through over the course of their novel. So I think it's a great way to like understand people more.
Why do you think you have a special place in your heart for the romance genre? Why that genre in particular?
I've always been a big lover of love, as I call myself. I literally dress like it's Valentine's Day every day. Like huge Valentine's Day gal. I'm very excited the holiday is coming up. And so I think love for me is just like the most beautiful of the human emotions. And so as much of that as I can experience in my life, I want to.
Do you have like a fancy bookmark or a heart on your book? I don't know. What are your bookmarks like?
I've got all kinds of bookmarks. I've got like some fancy metal ones. I've got free ones that came at bookstores, which are actually my favorite to read with because I don't have to worry about them getting damaged a bit. But all over.
What tips and advice do you have for how to not lose focus, how to stay present as you're reading that book and trying to absorb information? And even if you haven't quite gotten into the book where you feel like you can't put it down, what about focus?
Yeah, so reading obviously uses a lot of brain power and it's like a muscle. So like when you first start out exercising, you may only be able to run like a mile at a time. Similar with reading, you may only be able to read like 20 pages without losing focus. And that's totally okay, but you just keep doing it. And then slowly and surely your focus will get better. And it's easy now for me to just sit down and read a whole book.
What do you think about reading multiple books at once?
I occasionally do it. It's not my preferred style, but I'll do it if I'm like reading a classic and something that's like a bit less academic, just to sort of have like a palate cleanser. So, you know, I think it could work for people depending on your reading style and what you're reading.
Something I have difficulty with is keeping character names straight, places straight. And sometimes, you know, books do have a little bit of shortcuts. Maybe they have a map for you or a list of characters. But that is something I struggle with in remembering who is who. How do you do that?
It definitely helps that I'm like normally not spending more than like 2 days on a book. So I just get to like immerse myself into the characters. But if you are taking like a while to read, I think like reading the synopsis for the main characters is super useful just to like refresh yourself on, oh, what are these people's names again? But also just like looking back in the book and what you've already read can also be useful. But I also lose names too. So it's a common thing.
We're talking with Kyla Vaughn, a senior at UW-Madison, and we're talking about this feat of reading 392 books in 2021. Perhaps you read a lot of books. What would you like to ask Kyla? 800-642-1234. Now it's time for some recommendations. You brought us some romance recommendation. Very fitting for you, Kyla. We get it. So one book you recommend is Well Met. What's going on there?
Yeah, so Well Met is the first book in one of my favorite romance series. It follows Emily, who has moved back to her small hometown to take care of her sister, who's been in a car accident. And there she meets Simon, who is not only a high school English teacher, but also helps run the town's Renaissance Fair. And she thinks that's a stupid idea, but she ends up going to the Renaissance Fair and falling in love with Simon. And it's beautiful. As a Renaissance Fair lover myself, I definitely want that romance for sure.
Written in the Stars is a rom-com about two women who come from completely different worlds. How was it to find quality romance novels that don't follow heterosexual couples or narratives, conventional narratives?
Yeah, so I think it's definitely something we're seeing a lot more of in the past 2 years. I'm a lot more easily able to find female romances, which I really enjoy. And so I think you kind of have to go for like new releases, which thankfully there are a lot coming out this year that are female romances. The third book in this series actually just came out, I believe, yesterday. But yeah, it's so great to see, and I love being like represented in books. And so anytime I find a new female romance, especially one that like is so well written, like Written in the Stars, I'm just so excited to see it.
When you say it's well written, what drew you into Written in the Stars? What said, yeah, you know, that this is really good?
Yeah, so it actually has one of my favorite tropes in romance, which is fake dating, where the characters, for whatever reason, have to date each other when they don't have romantic feelings for each other, and then they end up falling for each other. And there's just something about that trope that, like, I will pick up any book that advertises fake dating.
Okay, next one, A Rogue of One's Own. Tell us about it.
Yes, so this is the second book in the Bringing Down the Duke series by Evie Dunmore. The whole series follows a group of female suffragettes at Oxford in London, and the men that they're falling in love with and then also convincing to their suffragette cause. So it's a great mix of like politics and historical details that are really well researched, and then also the romance side of things. So this one specifically follows Lucy and Tristan, and Lucy is a publisher, and she's a lovely, strong female character, and she's great. So I really enjoyed following her of all the heroines in that series.
So did this feat help you in your academics, do you think, or in helping you land a job after graduation? What will you take away from doing this?
Yeah, so I actually, in November, signed on to work at Epic in Verona after graduation. And one of the components of that interview is doing a 10-minute presentation on a topic of your choice. And I talked about romance novels. I talked about the structure and like the form, because they follow like a pretty standard, like, here's the conflict, you know, style. So I talked about that, and I talked about why I loved them. And I did land the job, so it might have been the romance novels that did it.
Kyla, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kyla Vaughn is a senior at UW-Madison, double major in English and history, graduating in the spring. 392, mark that down, go for it. Just ahead, how satisfied are you with your job? We'll discuss the best ways to make a career change and why so many people are giving jobs a second thought in these times. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.